From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how might Washington force automakers to speed up their recalls? Try the threat of jail.
You know, there's a lot of pressure on engineers to make the right decision because they're worried that years from now the Justice Department is going to come back and question whether they were following the law.
Marking 4 years since the Enbridge oil spill near the Kalamazoo River.
Fair to say, especially in those communities where that pipeline has been replaced, that, you know, trust or favorability of Enbridge is probably at an all-time low.
Singer-songwriter Liz Lahren talks about her new album and making music on her terms.
I was cutting off my creative flow by letting executives tell me what I should be doing and what I should be writing and how I should be presenting myself.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. GM's ignition switch disaster has led to 4 hearings on Capitol Hill. And now some members of Congress want to do something to get automakers to speed up the recall process, get problem vehicles repaired. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, could the threat of jail get automakers to speed up the recalls? But first, this week marks 4 years since a pipeline operated by Enbridge Energy burst in Michigan. It was a segment of Line 6B, located just downstream from the pump station in Marshall. The result? Well, the company says more than 800,000 gallons of oil poured into the Kalamazoo River. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith is here. Hello, Lindsay.
Hey, Cindy.
Good to have you with us. And from the Environment Report, always happy to see Rebecca Williams. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Cindy.
4 years after this Enbridge spill, Lindsay, tell us where things stand along the Kalamazoo River and also the affected lakes.
The oil spill affected about 40-mile stretch of the Kalamazoo River from near Marshall to almost Kalamazoo, if you're going to ballpark it. And for the most part, I would say the bulk of the oil has been cleaned up. The bulk of the cleanup work is done. Where things stand, you know, you can fish, you can swim, you can do all the things that you used to do in the river before the spill.
Rebecca, how effective was Enbridge in responding to the accident and then taking ownership and cleaning things up?
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board investigated that very thing, and they compared the company to the Keystone Cops for how they handled the spill. So not very flattering, and a highly critical report. And what happened in their investigation, they found what happened was that 3 shifts of Enbridge employees in Canada ignored alarms that there was a rupture because they thought it was a loss of pressure. And so twice they turned up the pressure in the line and spilled much more oil than they would have otherwise. So 17 hours went by before the company addressed the pipeline break, and oil was spilling out that entire time. The cleanup is still going on, as we've heard, and people in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency's work on the ground said a couple of years ago that they were writing the book on how to clean up this kind of oil from a freshwater system.
Wow. And in fact, I looked on the EPA's website and I see that they're dredging Morrow Lake this summer and they're still having to close areas of the river. And you wonder, Rebecca, will this thing ever truly be cleaned up?
Well, there will probably always be some oil in the system. And the reason for that is that you can't get every last drop of oil out anytime. But what agencies here in Michigan have said, you often don't want to take all the oil out of sensitive habitats because you could end up doing more damage if you were to do that. I spoke with Steve Hamilton. He's a professor at the Kellogg Biological Station at Michigan State University. And here's what he said about the effects of the spill.
That's the big question for this system. I can't say. If you look at the scientific literature, you can find plenty of evidence for long-lasting effects. And one that's been studied a lot is the Exxon Valdez spill up in the Alaska marine area. And in that case, the oil has persisted in beaches and in sediments for a very long time, and toxic effects have been detected. Now, that's it's a different kind of oil, and it's a colder environment and also marine, so you can't say for sure, but it's possible.
One of the things about this dredging work, it's a pretty invasive process. I mean, that's ultimately, like, it can really just scraping up the bottom of the river. The work that they're doing right now, which is this dredging work, if you're in Morrow Lake, it's pretty intense in that area, and that's why parts of it are closed for safety reasons. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, the reason that the EPA required this type of dredging work is because the Clean Water Act requires that if you stir up the river bottom and an oil sheen comes to the surface, like if you spilled some oil onto a water surface, that's not allowed under the Clean Water Act. So that's why the EPA has required this work to be done, because there's still sections of the river where you would kind of stir things up and get this sheen that floated to the surface. So the goal of the dredging work that's underway now is to get rid of that.
Lindsay, I have to wonder, what is the effect, in the life, the water life and the ecology of the river and the lakes of all this dredging?
It can really be invasive and hurt a lot of habitat. So that's why the EPA was strategic about where they wanted this work done. You know, ultimately, a lot of the rest of the long-term cleanup efforts, once we get past what the EPA has ordered with this dredge work, a lot of it is going to be passive collection, what they call passive collection, because it'll be, you know, some of the stuff will get stirred up, and then there's these little, like, traps that will collect the oil in a way that is not as harsh on the environment and as harsh on the wildlife habitat, because it's not something that you really want to be doing a ton of if you don't have to.
Lindsay, there seems to be somewhat of a disconnect about the amount of oil the company said, Enbridge said, was spilled and actually how much has been recovered. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy. The company says that roughly more than 800,000 gallons of crude oil leaked from their pipeline. So that's about how much they're missing from their pipeline, right? But the amount that's been recovered, the EPA says that they have taken out of the river more than 1 million gallons of oil. And it also includes stuff that's like, you know, it's not 4 years later, this is not the same oil that spilled, right? It's diluted, it's watery, it's mixed up with plant vegetation. If you're pulling, you know, cattails and swamp matter, you know, you think of your average Michigan swamp, you're pulling that out. That is also included in this total amount. So it's a rough estimate, and that's why the two numbers really don't match up.
I'm curious how the spill really impacted the lives of the people who live nearby.
The people who live nearby definitely were impacted the most. A lot of the people who lived really close to the spill moved. The Enbridge bought a number of houses in the area. The village of Ceresco is immediately downstream from Marshall, where the spill happened. You know, that's not even remotely the same village that it once was, because you've had so many people move out, and it's a really small town, so the businesses that were there have been impacted, obviously negatively. There's a historic dam that was there since like the 1800s, or mid-1800s, that has been removed as part of this process, and there was a lake upstream from that dam. Now that that dam's been taken out, that lake really is no longer. So that is certainly sort of changed what people know and remember the area as being. So it's definitely impacted people more closer to the spill directly than those who are further downstream.
Let's talk about long-range effects of this spill. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the ultimate toll, first on the people and the environment. Rebecca?
So that's there was a lot of study that, you know, was going on at the time, but people like Steve Hamilton at the Kellogg Biological Station, he told me that, you know, there are many things to still keep an eye on and to study longer term. He points out that there could be things going on that we can't easily detect.
You know, counts of abundance of different fish species and different invertebrate species that would require pretty careful and expensive study to reveal.
And money.
And
expensive,
money.
He said. Expensive.
He mentioned funding,
and your take on this, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about lasting impacts, I mean, I feel like there's a couple of takeaways. One is, I think everybody in the state of Michigan, hands down, has way more knowledge of pipelines that go through their backyard, or that these pipelines even exist. I think before this, a lot of people maybe just didn't even know about them. There's been a lot of talk about Enbridge's pipeline up through the Straits of Mackinac, which is a similar pipeline to the one that ruptured here. So, you know, there's a lot more awareness, I think, of pipeline safety and those kinds of issues. the state attorney general's office. I mean, and that the environmental quality department is also, you know, getting more maybe preemptively involved or trying to prevent these kinds of things from happening again. Politicians certainly are becoming more involved in scolding Enbridge and companies like them to be more upfront about, you know, preventing this type of thing from happening. And then I think the other thing is, you know, the amount of money is really staggering. You know, we didn't talk about this yet, but Enbridge has spent over $1 billion cleaning up this spill. I imagine they will spend much more than that ultimately, because once the EPA is done with their requirements, the federal regulators for the dredging, the state will ultimately take on the rest of the cleanup efforts, the sort of long-term passive stuff. So that's a cost to the state of Michigan, and the taxpayers obviously support that.
And what is this done, do you think, Rebecca, in the way that we regard these big energy companies? We've got Enbridge there. We hear talk that the Rover natural gas pipeline might come in and track right along by 6B. What has this done to how we regard those companies?
Well, one of the things that I've heard quite a bit, especially from people who have rights of way in their backyard that they didn't really think about, which Lindsay mentioned, people have a lot more awareness of what's running through their backyard. And the people who live near the pipeline route have, by and large, expressed a lot of frustration and anger at Enbridge with how they've dealt with the replacement of Line 6B, this new bigger pipeline that's come in. And I think that there is a lot more skepticism than there was before this bill.
Yeah, big time. I would say it's fair to say, especially in those communities where that pipeline has been replaced, that, you know, trust or favorability of Enbridge is probably at an all-time low.
Marking the four-year anniversary of the Enbridge spill, Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, our West Michigan reporter, and Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is one of the most famous missing person cases in American history. It all began with a lunch meeting at a restaurant in Bloomfield Township in Oakland County, the last time labor leader Jimmy Hoffa was ever seen. And it ended, well, it hasn't really ended. No body has ever been found, and no one was ever charged in the disappearance. The mystery of Jimmy Hoffa is the subject of an episode of PBS History Detective Special Investigation. It airs tonight on PBS stations. In the program, we meet Greg Stayskull of Washtenaw County. Greg's a now retired FBI special agent who investigated Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance, and he is with us now. Thanks for talking with us, Greg.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Greg, what do you remember about when you first got the call? Here you are, not even 2 months into your shiny new FBI career, and this big call comes in.
Well, when he disappeared, it was a case that, that of course, resonated throughout the FBI. And the headquarters back in Washington made it what we called a Bureau Special, which is basically all hands on deck and all agents, you know, assuming that they weren't doing anything of imminent importance, dropped everything and started doing an investigation on this case. So even as a relatively new agent, I was immediately involved in a lot of the early investigation of Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance.
And Greg, what did you all start to do right from the get-go? How quickly were you on it, and what were you doing?
Well, of course, we had agents that were assigned and dedicated to doing investigations of labor corruption and organized crime, which in Detroit was primarily, at least at that time, was the Detroit family of the La Cosa Nostra. As a relatively new agent, I was sent up to the up to Oakland County, and was for the first couple days, I was involved with doing what we call neighborhood investigation, where we were going around. The last place he was seen was the Macus Red Fox restaurant, and basically we're trying to establish a timeline as to when he was there, what we could determine as to what his activities were while he was there, and whether or not anybody actually saw him leave and with whom.
And that's a question a lot of us had. We've heard, well, he thought he was having a lunch meeting at the Marcus Red Fox restaurant at Maple and Telegraph in Bloomfield Township, a busy, busy corner, and poof. So what can you tell us about what happened on that day, that on July 30th, when he was going to that meeting?
Well, we know that he was at the Marcus Red Fox restaurant and also had gone into at least one other business. There's a small shopping center located just adjacent to the restaurant. And we know that he went in there and used the payphone. This is, of course, pre-cell phones and everything. So he had used the payphone in the hardware store near the restaurant. We developed that information. We also talked to several people who actually either saw Jimmy Hoffa, in one case, somebody that actually engaged him in a short conversation. So we know he was there. And we also had at least one witness that saw him talking to some people in a car, and at least one witness that actually saw him leaving in what seemed to be the same car, which was a 1975 Mercury sedan.
I'm speaking with retired FBI Special Agent Greg Stayskull, who is a part of a special episode tonight of PBS History Detective Special Investigation, looking into the disappearance 39 years ago this month of labor leader Jimmy Hoffa. Greg, when, at what point, did you and the FBI think, we are looking for a body now? How long did that take?
You know, I think it was relatively soon afterwards, when there was no word or no report and no indication of where he was. I think it was relatively soon that that we determined that he had probably been murdered, and that we were doing a murder investigation, looking for a body, and as opposed to a kidnapping type situation.
And as a nation, we are fascinated with, where is Jimmy Hoffa's body? Why do you think that is, and why there seems to be a dig every year or so? There's some field in Michigan or somebody's backyard is getting dug up looking for Jimmy Hoffa.
Well, you know, I think conspiracies, I guess nature abhors a vacuum. And when you don't know what happened to the body, that I think it naturally, various conspiracy theories develop, and some of them take on a life of their own. And because we've never found the body, you know, people come up with basic scenarios and things, some relatively outlandish. But I think that's the reason. And because we've never found an answer or anything, I think it also, there's a certain amount of fascination with the thing.
People are talking or not on their deathbeds, and documents are becoming unsealed all these decades later. Do you ever expect the mystery of Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance to be definitively solved?
Well, you know, I don't think it'll be definitively solved, in the sense that I doubt that there will ever be anybody prosecuted for it. However, you know, hope springs eternal, and it would be nice that if we came up with some information. I don't think that we'll ever find the body, because I think the body no longer exists, and in my estimation probably hasn't existed in, since very soon after the time he disappeared. But that being said, there may be, and as time goes on, there's fewer and fewer people that really know for sure, there may be somebody come forward, and there may be something of some type of evidence that would tell us exactly what happened. But I'm not sure that'll happen. And as time goes on, it becomes less and less of a possibility.
Greg Stayskull is an FBI special agent who has retired to Washtenaw County. He will be part of the program History Detectives Special Investigation, airing tonight on PBS. A fascinating look back to that time 39 years ago, that summer day. Greg, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
She has been on the scene since 1986. I was working at a Detroit radio station that was the first to play her song, Hot Pursuit. Her music has gone through many changes, including how she makes it and where she makes it. Oakland County-based singer-songwriter and producer Liz Lahren, the title track, Hurricane.
I can't imagine how we float like clouds, forming and reforming, never dreaming out loud. We're storming and restoring, and breaking open now, and falling to the earth in the fall.
She's coming to the ARC on August 3rd. Liz Lehrin, welcome to Stateside.
Wonderful to be here with you.
Tell us about Hurricane, the title track.
Hurricane is, of course, the title track because it is, that is the feeling that of change, the whirlwind. You look around, things just look crazy. You're trying to hang on. You're trying to ground yourself. And it's a feeling of what is real. And that is the start of the journey. That you know, because if you're totally comfortable, then you never go on to, you'll never hit the road or explore anything new. So it has to be, you have to be uncomfortable. And hurricanes are very uncomfortable and scary. But in this way, it's a joyous way of saying, okay, there's chaos here, and I am going to go with this. I'm going to grasp this. I'm going to go on this journey.
Play almost all of the instruments, and you sing all of the vocals on your record. Why is that?
I like to use all the resources that I have, and I wanted to make sure that what I was hearing in my head, I was able to put down on the CD. One day it'll be a full orchestra and 20 singers, but just to get the thing rolling and to put the music out there.
Now, I remember back in the 80s, you began with a band. What has that evolution been like to being the person who's virtually the one woman band now?
I've become more confident in my initial, musical instincts. And as I've gone, I've realized that my first instinct seems to be good, and then I build on that. And it seemed that when I was able to add visuals, that was able to communicate the idea even more clearly. So I just I hone the songs until the idea is as clear as possible and as visual as possible. I want the listener to be able to listen to it and picture something to the right of them, to the left of them, and what is actually going on while they're moving through the music.
And you have branched really beyond the art of music and sound, and now you create visual images behind you on stage.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. What led you to that?
We're just in such a visual world now. And I realized that, a picture is worth 1,000 words, of course, but video is worth even more. So I taught myself computer graphics, and because when I'm writing the music and when I'm producing the music and performing it, I'm picturing colors and movement. And I thought, well, why don't I create that for the audience so that they can see what I've, what's going on in my head. And I just think it's just a lot more fun for the audience to have something to watch as well as watching a performer. They have basically a whole movie going on.
How would you describe what you do?
That's a good question. I would say it's cinematic. It's theatrical. It's moving away from just being a band or just being a singer-songwriter. I see a vision of the future of music where people are, where the performer engages the audience on many, many levels. And they're all, we're already moving toward that. But I think things like, Google glasses and, wearable cameras, we're all sort of becoming movie makers and writers. Because the audience is 50% of this. So what the audience brings to it, they get to put together what they think the story is for themselves.
Liz, what inspires you to write? Do you have to be in pain or in joy? What events inspired this record?
I think it always stems from a feeling that because I stuttered for most of my life, language and speaking for me was secondary. And I realized that we are communicating constantly beyond words in art and in storytelling and in music. We are communicating ideas. And I think it is the feeling of being able to communicate on a deeper level than just our language. Sometimes I find language limiting, or maybe that's just me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. My guest is music artist Liz Lehrin. She's at the ARC Sunday, August 3rd. There's a track called Superhero on your new CD, and I want you to tell us what's behind that very emotional lyric.
It was very strange. The first five times I talked to anybody about the song, I was crying. It was a story that I felt very deep inside me, and it is the story of a parent and a parent's love for a child, and how when a child is sick or suffering, how a parent would absolutely trade their lives. They would trade anything to eliminate the suffering of their child. And that was the vision that I had, was a parent in a hospital room with a child. And this child, 6 months earlier, was running around in a superhero outfit. And I'm going to cry just talking about it. But, oh, geez.
And now they're in the hospital.
Yeah.
And on my shoulder, someone says it's time to go. I never leave you. This you know. And if I could be a superhero, I would fly.
Felt like what parents feel, what all of them feel at the same time. And it was just overwhelming. And so I ended up, the song came to me very, very quickly. But the parent wants to be the superhero, because as children, we believe in superheroes. And then when we become adults, we say, well, there's really no such thing. But there is a superhero when we are willing to sacrifice ourselves for somebody else. We do become a version of a superhero, and I think that is important.
Do you have kids yourself?
I don't. I have not been fortunate enough. I'm happy to say I'm a godmother and an aunt, and I'm very, very happy about that. And my songs are sort of my children a bit.
You know, Liz, you truly are a fixture on Michigan's music scenes with, I've lost track how many Detroit Music Awards to your credit. But back in the 80s, you went to England and you worked with producer Rupert Hine, who worked with Stevie Nicks, Tina Turner, The Fix. What did that give you?
I was so privileged to be able to go to England and work with Rupert because it taught me, because he basically taught us that you have to create an environment for yourself in order to feel creative. So you have to he created that for us in the studio so that we could focus fully on music. And it was just, you know, life's crazy and the phone's ringing and there's bills to pay, but to have that opportunity to go deep, like that, and the English music legacy, I really admire quite a bit. So being able, you know, thinking Sting lives down the street, and there's Kate Bush in the next village, and it was kind of heady.
And then you were in L.A. and New York, and kind of back and forth. What was that like?
I realized that I don't know if I'm really cut out for the music business. I was on Atlantic Records, and I ran into a bunch of people who perceived music as a business. And that's not why I signed up for it. And to hop on board with them, I felt like I was selling myself short. I was cutting off my creative flow by letting executives tell me what I should be doing and what I should be writing and how I should be presenting myself. So it took me a while, but I kind of came to my senses and ended up coming back to Michigan, where I felt really creative and I was around friends and family, and I could get back to work and just let the music business do what it's going to do, and all the Katy Perrys of the world and just let them go on, and I'm just going to continue to do what I'm doing artistically.
Oakland County-based singer-songwriter Liz Laren. Her new CD is Hurricane, and her website is LizLarenMusic.com. That's LizLarenMusic.com. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Really, really appreciate it.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. General Motors' ignition switch disaster has led to four hearings on Capitol Hill. Now some members of Congress want to do something to get automakers to speed up the recall process, get those problem vehicles repaired. In other words, no more foot dragging has happened with the GM ignition switches. David Shepardson is D.C. Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, we could certainly tell that members of those House and Senate panels were, to say the least, very unhappy with what they heard from GM about the ignition switches. Now some movement to fix what they see as a problem?
That's right. Members of both parties in the Obama administration are pushing to get new eminent hazard authority, which would allow the agency to get unsafe vehicles off the road quickly. Today, it takes a lengthy two-step process involving a preliminary evaluation and then a full-scale investigation. That can take at least a year to get vehicles off the road. So it's not a quick process by any means.
So basically, it sounds like we're talking about sharpening the teeth of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, of NHTSA.
That's right. The legislative proposals would give them more money for more investigators, as well as a much higher fine. The current maximum fine is only $35 million. And that's, as the Transportation Secretary said, a drop in the bucket. It's basically not really an impact on the bottom line for companies like GM that have $150 billion in revenue and $4 billion in profits last year. So they would propose hiking the fines to $300 million and up from $35 million. And a separate bill would impose criminal penalties on an auto executive or other business executive who did not disclose unsafe vehicles or unsafe products to the government within 24 hours of warning of them.
That certainly calls for speed, and I would suspect that would get the attention of folks in offices at all the auto companies.
All right. So currently what's motivating members of auto companies and other businesses is the threat of bad publicity, that if you don't do the right thing, your business is going to, you know, decline precipitously if it gets lots of attention, but you're not really motivated by the threat of prison or the direct fine. But what also has happened recently, which what we saw with Toyota back in March when the Justice Department fined them $1.2 billion and actually charged the company with wire fraud, is that there are some old-scale tools to prevent companies from doing the wrong thing. It's just they're not as easy and not as tailored directly to auto safety issues.
How likely do you think these proposals would get through Congress?
Well, the Republican chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Fred Upton, from Southwest Michigan, has said he is looking at a number of ideas. He thinks he'll propose his own auto safety bill by early next year. So I don't think anything will get through this year, but I think with a new highway bill coming up next May, because Congress just passed its 27th temporary patch in 5 years to keep the funds running for the roads, that's typically a time when the government and the Congress does a real full-scale look at auto safety. So I'd expect there to be some legislation on this issue, but I think it's unknown which bill will get through. And the interesting thing is that to pay for this big expansion in auto safety investigators, Democrats would actually impose a $3 new vehicle tax, which would rise to $9 over 3 years. That would raise, you know, $60, $70, $80 million a year when all is said and done, but it would be the first time that there was such a tax, and auto companies are very nervous about imposing a federal tax because, you know, think of the Spanish-American War, where the telephone tax was imposed 100 years ago to pay for the war, and 100 years later, it was still on the bills.
We're speaking with David Shepardson, who's the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, as we look at a push in Washington for basically a faster pace for auto recalls. And David, NHTSA's role in the GM ignition switch problems, it's time for NHTSA to be in the spotlight in upcoming House and Senate panel hearings. How does this look for NHTSA?
Well, they've got a lot of questions to answer, and it's really twofold. I mean, in one sense, we're looking at a snapshot in time before Toyota. I mean, the agency has acknowledged a lot of problems. They were not aggressive enough before the Toyota sudden acceleration problems in 2009 and 2010. In fact, Toyota, if you remember, bragged about convincing NHTSA not to force them to do a mechanical fix, saving $100 million. Instead, they only replaced 50,000 floor mats. But today, the agency is far more aggressive, but they're going to have to answer the key question, which is back in 2006 when a senior government investigator came to the agency and said, hey, we've got four crashes with fatalities in Cobalt vehicles, and I want us to open a formal investigation. The agency said no. Unfortunately, the agency kept very few records of what and how it decided those decisions. So it's been problematic to figure out why the agency wasn't more aggressive back then, when at the same time they were investigating other issues where there were no fatalities. So the agency does have questions to answer, and I think, you know, what you're seeing now is the agency is really not taking no for an answer, because Congress, again, has expressed a lot of frustration, and there's really no there's no benefit to from the agency's point of view in not being tough on the companies, because another screw-up in the perception of Congress could lead to big changes at the agency.
And what is the message, do you think, to auto engineers and executives in all of this?
I think that's a perfect question, because, look, you know, these are not easy decisions always. It's not always black and white. What happens is you start getting complaints, you look at the issue, and you try to figure it out. It's not easy to understand the root cause. It can take companies months or years. You know, now sometimes there's foot dragging, but sometimes it's just, how do we figure out what's going on, because we want to fix the problem. We don't know what it is. I mean, taking the case of this recent airbag recall that led to 10 million vehicles being recalled by seven auto companies, it was because, you know, at high humidity, the airbags didn't work, and there was shrapnel coming out of the airbags into drivers, but not something they ever anticipated. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure on engineers to make the right decision, because they're worried that years from now the Justice Department is going to come back and question whether they were following the law.
So they have a balancing act to strike.
Absolutely. I think right now the balance is tipped in favor of recall first and ask questions later.
Also, David Shepherdson, you're reporting a separate story that GM could be ready to create up to 1,750 new jobs and up to $800 million in new investment in Michigan. And tell us what this is about.
Well, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation filed a new report about proposed tax incentives, and it is, you know, it's one of the big success stories for the state, is that as the auto companies went through this painful shrinking, they've really focused a lot of their emphasis on, you know, the core areas, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan really could be a big winner with all these new jobs, as they, you know, with demand at record high for the auto industry and the plants are running at full tilt. There's a lot of places where, you know, an expansion, you know, could lead to new jobs and new and more products. And so I think that's something we're going to see, you know, more details precisely on what new vehicles and new jobs in the next coming months.
So it's about amending the automaker's global state tax credit, and that can lead to this.
Exactly. I mean, this all, big companies are constantly basically proposing new jobs and getting new incentives from the state. And but this is a big number. If you think about it, since bankruptcy, GM has, you know, added, you know, well over 10,000 jobs, you know, nationwide, and this would be a big victory for the state.
David Shepherdson is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, thanks for your time.
Thanks, guys.
The battle lines are now even more clearly drawn in the upcoming Detroit bankruptcy trial. Now that Detroit's pensioners have officially said yes to the grand bargain, the bond insurers who could lose billions in Detroit's bankruptcy are basically saying it's go time. Let's fight. Nancy Kaffer is a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Nancy, emergency manager Kevin Orr warned retirees this was not the time to vote no and hope for something better. So enough of them seem to have heard the message?
I think they did. There were a pretty overwhelming vote to approve this deal, which includes substantial cuts to pension and health care. So they seem to have figured out that this is the best deal that was available.
Break it down for us, because I know we're talking about two groups, the police and fire, and also the civilian pensioners. How did each group vote?
So the police and fire retirees, who are going to get 100% of their monthly pension checks, but a significant reduction in their annual cost of living increases, they voted 82% in favor. The general retirement pensioners, who are going to get 95.5% of their monthly pension checks, no cost of living increases going forward, and they're going to have to repay some what the city's calling excess annuity savings fund distributions. They voted 73% in favor.
All right. So it wasn't a squeaker. It was, as you say, it was by a healthy margin. Retirees also had a question. They voted on a separate ballot about their health care benefits.
Yes, they took a 90% reduction in benefits. So, I mean, that's substantial. Imagine if you had to pay 90% more for your health care than you're doing right now, which there's going to be some money that's going to come in to help. Some of these people will be eligible for some subsidies on the health care exchanges. Some will be eligible for Medicare or Medicaid, depending on age. So I mean, there's going to be some things that sort of layer in to help these folks, but it's not an insignificant cut there.
No, so this isn't celebration time, because every one of these people are going to be hurt.
They are, but you know, the thing is that the city is bankrupt. I mean, there's no money here, and they're still getting a significantly sweeter deal than a lot of creditors, which is very appropriate. They should get a better deal, because creditors, big banks, bond insurers, those guys have ways to manage risk. They charge higher insurance or interest rates. They can insure debt. They have ways to manage risks in the way that you and I, regular citizens, counting on pensions and health care benefits, do not. But you know, the reality is that this is the best deal that was available, that there's money coming in from foundations, from the state government, to from the DIA itself to secure the DIA collection and to put money into the pension system to sort of reduce the harshness of these cuts. And this is, I think folks looked at this, they did the math, and they came to a conclusion that they're certainly not happy about, but realize is the best case scenario.
But in the other corner, waving their legal filings like swords, we have especially the two big bond insurers, Syncora and Financial Guarantee Insurance Company, FGIC. And now that the vote is in from the pensioners, it seems that they have really stiffened in their resolve to fight this thing right to the bitter end.
Yeah, they are getting, they're taking a really significant cut. Syncora and FGIC, as some call them apparently, the city's offering to pay 0 to 10% on the $1.4 billion that they're owed. So it's a pretty steep cut, and they're going to fight tooth and nail. Those are the groups all along that have been pushing for a sale of DIA art, that asked at one point for the court to allow them to take art out of the DIA to have it appraised. These are people who are very committed to fighting this plan.
Nancy, is there any chance, or are you hearing anything that leads us to think that there could be a chance of settling with Syncora and FGIC before the August 14th trial begins?
Gosh, at this point, I wouldn't even want to say. They've done some pretty dramatic stuff in this. You know, it's really funny to say that a bankruptcy has been dramatic, filled with hairpin twists and turns, but this one really has. I mean, at one point, the city in a court filing accused Syncora of orchestrating a scorched earth litigation strategy. They've seemed to have, you know, they have very outspokenly advocated for the sale of DIA artwork, as they've suggested that perhaps it's not, you know, appropriate for the city to continue to have such a valuable collection when they're deeply in debt, which I think is something most residents of our region would really protest.
Nancy, do bankruptcy experts have any feel about the chances of these bond insurers scuttling the grand bargain in the trial based on the claims that they're not being treated fairly?
So here's where it gets complicated. There's no creditors in a municipal bankruptcy. It's different from personal or corporate bankruptcies, because there's no such thing as forced liquidation in municipal bankruptcy. They cannot ask the judge, and the judge cannot force the city to sell artwork or any other asset. They can refuse to sign off on a deal that does not meet their requirements. That's how they can sort of hold things up and become sort of a wrench in the works of the bankruptcy exiting. I honestly don't know how that's all going to play out. There reaches a point when certain classes of creditors have approved various portions of the deal that the judge can cram down. The technical term is cram down a settlement onto even folks who have rejected it. I'm not sure if we've hit that threshold for a cram down, but it's certainly something that's all going to play out in this hearing that's going to start on August 14th, where the judge and with the assistance of a host of experts will decide whether or not this whole settlement plan is feasible, legal, and viable.
And that's what it takes to get the city out of bankruptcy in what would be a pretty astonishing record time.
It really, really is. Some cities or counties that have filed for bankruptcy under Chapter 9 have taken just this long to be deemed eligible for bankruptcy. And so the fact that they're sticking to this, I was very skeptical of this 18-month timeline when it was first announced, because when you look at Jefferson County, Alabama, or Pritchard, Alabama, or the cities in California, Stockton, that have had municipal bankruptcies, it's taken them years and years, like I said, first of all, to even be deemed eligible for bankruptcy and then the negotiations process. But we have a couple of advantages here. A lot of folks have protested the involvement of emergency manager Kevin Orr and his law firm, his former law firm, Jones Day, that's been representing the city, saying that there's conflicts of interest, that we're giving, you know, giant law firms city money to do this work. But the fact is, these are internationally qualified firms, an internationally qualified firm and an internationally qualified bankruptcy attorney. We have really probably the best representation money can buy in this case, and I think we're seeing that at the speed at which things are happening. This is something where we needed top-of-the-line talent, because I got to tell you, these giant banks, these bond insurers, they're not going to bring, you know, a local attorney to the table. They're bringing internationally qualified people, and we have to meet, you know, their level of firepower with this equivalent level. And I think that that's one of the things we're seeing at how quickly things are moving, is the professional resources that the city's been able to bring to the table here.
Nancy Kaffer, columnist with the Detroit Free Press. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.